This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Jerome Groopman, writes about medical issues for The New Yorker. He's also a professor at the Harvard Medical School and is chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Another important credential that helps him understand healthcare is his experience as a patient dealing with pain. He had a back injury in 1979, a ruptured lumbar disc that left him in bad pain. His subsequent surgery only made matters worse. As we'll hear a little later, he lived with pain for about 19 years. His new book, The Anatomy of Hope, considers two questions. Why do some people find hope despite facing severe illness, while others do not? And can hope actually change the course of a malady, helping patients prevail? When you were a student, you were working with a doctor who was treating a woman whose cancer had spread to the liver. You were working with this woman, too. Once cancer has spread to the liver, usually the person doesn't have too long to go, but that's not what the doctor told this woman. What did he tell her? You described this in your book.
Well, I was learning, as you say, cancer medicine, the senior physician sort of set the path, and he used medical jargon with this woman and with her daughter. He used the word, he said the chemotherapy could be effective against the tumor, that she might have a remission. And that's factually true. But when people hear that, they think that means a cure, that the cancer could be totally eradicated. So what we were doing was really sidestepping the truth and giving her misinformation or incomplete information and regrettably false hope. And then it all blew up in our faces.
What happened?
Well, she became ill, as often happens, and it was clear that we had misled her. She kept her anger quiet, but her daughter was very bitter. And she said something to me, which has never left me. And she said, you know, you didn't trust the fact that we could cope with this. You didn't give us the opportunity to hope. And I think that I felt ashamed. I know I felt ashamed at that time. And it jarred me. And it showed me that there is no easy formula in terms of speaking to people about this, balancing the truth with hope.
What did she mean that you didn't give her a chance to hope? You gave her a lot of hope. It was false hope, but you gave her hope.
Well, I think what she meant was that she wanted to understand what she could hope for. What was realistic? Could she hope for a remission of months or perhaps a year or two? And also, I think when people have that kind of knowledge, the focus of their hope can shift. They can shift it away from the body and more to the spirit or the soul, if we can use those words, that they can focus on their relationships with loved ones, if they're religious, their relationship with God, and they can seek hope to repair things in their lives which need fixing in the time they have.
There's another issue with people with cancer. If you're giving them false hope for a cure, and if they go through chemotherapy that is going to give them horrible side effects, and if there's no chance of that chemotherapy really lengthening their life in any meaningful way, then you're ensuring that the end of their life is going to be miserable.
Absolutely. I think that it's a complex issue. Some people I've cared for will say, I don't want this. I don't want to suffer or to take the risk of suffering if it's not going to extend my life or if it's going to extend my life only for a matter of a month or two. I'd rather use that time, as much time as I have, for other purposes. And yet, as I write in the book, you have to be careful also not to rob someone of the right to resist. One of my colleagues at the hospital, and a very esteemed pathologist who's the world's expert in stomach cancer, developed stomach cancer, which, according to the textbook, is incurable. And I wasn't his doctor, but along with the other young cancer specialists on the staff, basically said, you know, I would recommend he not have any treatment. He should just go home and die, basically. And if my advice had been followed, he would be dead. And he had that small but finite response where he actually was cured. And he's alive 20 years later.
Now, when you think about that case, do you think, oh, it's because of the hope that he had, it's because of his will and his struggle? Or do you think he's that, like, you know, 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 1 million who, through a combination of things, is the one that survives?
I think that without hope, you're lost, meaning that you don't have the courage to try or the resilience to endure. But hope is not a magic wand. It's not, I'm going to think positively and my tumor will melt, or I'm going to feel good and my lupus will go into remission, something like that. It's not magic. There are biological effects to hope. But as you say, and I think correctly, many, many people who have tremendous hope don't succeed, at least in a physical way. They don't. Hope is not an automatic guarantee for a cure.
When you're delivering a bad diagnosis to a patient, how does your sense of the importance of hope, reasonable hope, affect the way you give the diagnosis?
It's central to it. I think that what I do is I lay out truthfully two scenarios. I always begin with the bad scenario. I say, we all know that there can be a worst case, that things may not work out, that the disease might not remit, the drugs may not work. We need to acknowledge that. And yet, there is a real possibility that we could prevail, and we'll do everything possible to get there so that the hope is real. And then you wait for the person to respond. Sometimes someone is so shocked and unnerved by the news that they're mute. And it's important in situations like that, I routinely encourage someone else to be by them so that they can ask the questions or engage more in discussion. Sometimes we need a second visit to go over what we talked about the first time and to reinforce the fact that there really is a chance, that there really is hope.
Now, the story that you were telling us about the doctor you were studying with when you were a med student who gave the woman with cancer false hope, he eventually got cancer himself, a rare form of cancer that starts in the bile ducts. And he was going to forego any treatment because he thought it was hopeless. And when a doctor told him to try, he'd say, hey, I play that game with my patients, but I'm too smart for that.
But he did.
So why did he decide finally to go through with chemo, or was it radiation?
It was radiation, and I think that he had to come to terms with the fact that there was a real chance. It was not clear. The odds were against him, but it was a possibility, and that there was a reason for him to try. He had a very close relationship with his wife. He was very gratified by his work. And I think that he had a sense that there was no hope because he had no possibility of control over his circumstances. And yet, in fact, he did. And the surgeon who cared for him had to bring him to that realization, which is not an easy thing to do. But it taught me how difficult it is for people to find hope in dire circumstances. But when hope is real, it's the primary imperative of the doctor to show it and to convince a person of its truth.
You know, I think for family and friends of somebody who's very sick, there is the desire to be, you know, realistic and all that, but also the desire to just be the best cheerleader that you can, to just be as supportive and as hopeful as possible in the hopes of strengthening the morale of the person that you love?
I think it's very important. Again, you never know how things work out. People can have, I've seen many people who were handed death sentences, which I've also in my training done and regret deeply. Oh, you know, this disease, you have 3 months to live, or you have 6 months to live, and now it's a year and a half. or 2 years. Or sometimes, and I've seen this several times in my career, a new drug or a new treatment arrives at a moment when it radically changes the prognosis. Look at testicular cancer in men. Recently, there are new antibodies for lymphoma, which is changing the remission rate and possibly the cure rate. Childhood leukemia. These were all diseases that were just uniformly fatal. And for those who were fortunate, a medication arrived in time. I used to have 12 to 15 people die of AIDS that I cared for a year. And then with the new drugs, it's not a cure of AIDS, but I've only had one person die in the last 2 years.
So that means you've had to change how you talk with patients about outcomes because the outcomes are so much better now.
The outcomes are better for many diseases. And there is a tremendous amount of research going on. So you don't want to hold out false hope and say, oh, yes, you know, there's a drug just around the corner and it's going to save you, because you don't know that. But you can say honestly that in a number of different diseases, breast cancer, colon cancer, a variety of blood diseases, there is such a concerted effort that perhaps if we can keep you in quality of life and in remission, a new treatment will arrive that really will make a fundamental difference.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman. He writes about medical issues for The New Yorker. His new book is called The Anatomy of Hope: How People Prevail in the Face of Illness. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman. He writes about medical issues for The New Yorker magazine. His new book is called The Anatomy of Hope: How People Prevail in the Face of Illness. Some of the patients you've treated over the years have found, you know, strength and hope through prayer and faith. Other patients who you've treated don't have that to turn to, don't have faith or religion, you know, to lean on. You talk briefly about your father, and you say when your father was dying, he had like just a personal philosophy that he turned to, and I was wondering what that was.
My father was a free thinker. I was brought up in a home where there was both tradition as well as doubt. And he didn't have a sense that there was necessarily an afterlife. None of us knows whether there is or there isn't really. But what he did feel, and he communicated to me, was that there was memory, that who he was as a person and what he taught his children would live on after he was gone. And he found great comfort in that.
So the way you describe it, it sounds like your father didn't exactly have a deep sense of religion to turn to, but he had some kind of larger personal understanding of life and death that he was comfortable with and that he was able to turn to put his own impending death in some kind of perspective.
He did. I think people often assume that only individuals who are deeply religious can cope with facing their mortality. My father was remarkable. He was a man I love very deeply. And he saw death as a natural part of life. I'm sure he was afraid of it on some level. But on the other hand, he had seen it. He'd been a soldier in the French front and in World War II, an American soldier. His own father had died when he was relatively young. And he looked for ways to find strength and to find courage outside strictly of a theological framework. And he found it in memory, the power of memory, that who he was as a person and what he had taught his children would live on after him.
One chapter in your new book is devoted to your own story. You had a serious back problem in 1979. You want to just describe what your problem was?
Well, I had ruptured a disc, and I was a marathon runner. I was young and very impulsive, and went doctor shopping until I found a surgeon who said that he would fix me and everything would be set and I'd be back doing sports aggressively, and he would fuse the lower part of my spine. And I underwent the operation, and I woke up, and I couldn't move my legs. And there had been a complication during the surgery, and for months I was in excruciating pain. And he basically said that this would be my fate, that the pain would subside somewhat, but that I would be severely debilitated for the rest of my life. And in fact, for 19 years, I lived that way. I lived as though I were inside an electric fence. Every time I would try to venture too far, walk too far, or lift one of my kids or something like that, my back would go into spasm. So this was the narrative that played in my mind. And then it turned out he was wrong.
Well, you went to see a specialist. And I love this part of the book. The specialist told you that you were worshiping the volcano god of pain. Who is this god?
Well, I saw a very brash, in-your-face physical medicine doctor, a physiatrist named Jim Rainville. And he swaggered in and he said, just what you said, Terry, you're worshiping the volcano god of pain, meaning that every time I felt pain, I would bow down and retreat, lie down and stop. And in fact, my interpretation of the pain was that it was danger and harm. But the truth was that that pain was reflecting the fact that my muscles had atrophied, my ligaments had contracted, and I had to disregard the pain. And I had to build myself up through a very gradual but persistent set of exercises to overcome the pain. And then, in an incredible way, my functioning returned. And I became largely pain-free. And I could live again. I felt I was reborn. And I stopped worshiping that god.
And this doctor also told you that you had to erase the memory of pain from your muscles. And I've read that in other places, that muscles and nerves actually remember pain in a way. And the more they experience it, the more good they are at activating pain real quickly.
That's absolutely true. In fact, I saw a paper in Nature, a very prestigious British scientific journal, about a year ago, showing in models of pain that there are actual changes in the circuits in the spinal cord and the brain, so that it's sort of this vicious cycle where, as you say, you keep imprinting in your mind and in your body these pathways of pain, and they become much more acute.
Now, when I was reading this part of your story in your new book, The Anatomy of Hope, I was thinking about two things. One is, were you going to have that ability to hope, to be hopeful enough to try the regimen that this physiatrist wanted to put you through? But also, were you going to have the trust to trust him with your body? Because you knew that, in the past, if you pushed too far or overexerted yourself, there would be consequences to pay. So if this physiatrist was leading you in the wrong direction, you'd be suffering consequences instead of getting better. And that issue of hope and trust, I think, are really intertwined. And it's difficult to put your trust in the hands of somebody you don't really know when the consequences could mean lots of pain.
Absolutely. And this doctor is very wise because he saw that. He could read it in my face. And in a very brash way, he said, BS talks, but reality walks, meaning that I had to take the plunge and trust him, as you say. And I was very leery of this because I had suffered terribly. But what was interesting was that when he showed me that there was hope, when he said, here's a possible path, I felt at the same time this tremendous uplift. And I felt actually my body become more supple and I felt more ready. And every time I went through the program, which was very arduous, and I started to have pain, I would try to retrieve his words and retrieve the image of him towering over me as a way to spark hope and a way actually to dampen the pain.
So how has this experience with your own back and after 19 years finding a therapy that was effective for it, how has that affected how you talk with patients?
Well, it's shown me that hope can be very, very powerful. And it's also taught me that not only is there a mind-body connection, but there's also a body-mind connection. That when my body began to recover, my feelings of pleasure in life and my sense of hope were much more powerful. And so I try to support my patients through a difficult time physically. And when they begin to feel better in their body, you want a domino effect. You want that to be catalytic so that it can reinforce hope, and that hope, and that one looks to hope in a way to then give them the courage and the resilience to push to the end.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Jerome Groopman writes about medical issues for The New Yorker and is a professor at Harvard Medical School. His new book is called The Anatomy of Hope. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.